Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I'm Diana Isaacs, joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we have some exciting new updates regarding GLP-1 drugs. So first, we're going to talk about Triple G, the triple agonist, retatrutide. There's been some new top line data. And then second, there's actually quite an interesting article that was published in JAMA about some of the real-world prescribing of GLP-1s and how people are getting them. So let's dive right in. Let's start with retatrutide. I don't even know if I'm saying it correctly, but there was really exciting new data with Triumph 2 and Triumph 3. So Natalie, I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce what these new top-line studies showed us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Diana. Welcome, everyone. So let's dig right in. So we have two new studies. So the retatrutide has two Triumph studies that were top-line results. Remember, top-line is not detailed, but it's giving us an overview of what the big announcement. So Triumph 2 confers up to 21% weight loss and 1% A1C reduction. That's impressive. So the trial involved 1,000 patients and began way back in 2023, took place in 98 centers around the world. What does that tell us about it? That they looked for a diversity in population. They looked at 4, 9, and 12 milligram dosing, and it was, of course, a dose-dependent weight loss. We see this with every GLP-1, the GLP-GIP offer option that we have right now. And now we're seeing it again in this triple agonist. So it dose-dependent, up to 21% from a baseline of 106 kilos. Participants in the highest dose of 12 milligrams lost an average of 23 kilos or 50 pounds. That's significant given the baseline. So it improved glycemic management at week 80. So they did this and they looked at it for a long, long period of time. Because if we can fix something for 6 weeks, it doesn't matter, right? Diabetes needs a long time. And this is part of it, 80 weeks out, which is amazing, with participants achieving an A1C reduction between 1.4 and 1.6% A1C reduction compared to a reduction of 0.2 in placebo. We know this. This is what we see in the lots of placebo-controlled studies. So a low baseline, though, of 7.7%. So a lot of times in studies, people are recruited with an A1C, like an average of 9, and then we can see this drastic reduction. Well, in this study specifically, the average A1C starting point was 7.7%. So this is really impressive. So that's the biggest part of this Triumph 2. Diana, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, these are incredible changes in both A1C and in weight loss. And I mean, really, gosh, unparalleled in terms of the impact that it will have on people. I think it's very, very exciting. Of course, you know, there are side effects as well. So we have to kind of, you know, weigh that as well in terms of the discontinuation rates. We're a little bit higher. And the highest dose, I believe, had 14%. So, you know, it's a clinical trial. So usually they're trying to do everything they can to support people. And you have less discontinuation in trials. So that does seem a little bit on the higher side. But then again, in the real world, we don't need to push everyone to the highest dose. We can, you know, we can use lower doses and often achieve great outcomes. So I think it's really exciting. I think we're all looking forward to, you know, this becoming available.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's interesting too, though, because sometimes the trials will have mandatory forced titration, right? And right. What we've learned with GLP, GLP-GIP, and I'm sure with triple agonists that we're going to do them on our own terms. So a lot of times I will slow down titration to reduce the GI side effects. If I increase somebody up a dose and they start to having problems, I'm like, okay, wait, let's go back down. Let's do this slowly. Let's alternate weeks with different drug dosing. Let's even use a little bit of medication to help with nausea if it's transient, right? I guess 14% discontinuation, what does that mean? That means 80%, 86% continuation.
So that's true. Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of impressed with that. For this kind of weight loss, I would have thought they would have said 25% discontinuation, right? So the side effects are not unexpected, but I do, like, I'm thinking about it a little differently. 86% of people stayed on it. Wow.
Yeah, that is true. That is definitely a more glass half full way to look at it. And I think the other thing that is especially important is just how dramatic this A1C lowering is when their baseline A1C was, you know, in the sevens, right? That right. is really remarkable. Like, we expect A1C drops of this when you are at 9 or 10%, but not when you're 7 points.
Right.
Right. Yep. So to me, I mean, this builds off of also data that we have, you know, the SURPASS early with tirzepatide also showed a pretty dramatic A1C lowering in a population that didn't have a very high A1C. And I am hopeful this is going to be the new norm, that we introduce these powerhouse drugs early on and we essentially like put the diabetes in remission. We really get them into like normal glucose ranges and think about the ability to really hopefully prevent potential complications by treating it so early on.
I love that idea. So now let's look at Triumph 3. So remember that Triumph 2 was with diabetes. Well, what happens when we look at people with obesity? And the thing is, we always see a little bit more or sometimes a lot more weight loss when we're treating obesity, but not diabetes with it. And again, here we go, right? It conferred a 23% weight loss or about 56 pounds on average, 56 pounds. And on top of that, reduced cardiovascular risk factors, including triglycerides, non-HDL cholesterol, and systolic blood pressure. So again, an 80-week trial with over 1,900 people enrolled with class 2 or class 3 obesity. What does that mean? The BMI needed to be greater than or equal to 35 and established cardiovascular disease. So you can't start a trial looking for cardiovascular. You have to have established cardiovascular disease to be in this trial. Across these global study sites, randomizing people to 9 milligrams or 12 milligrams or the placebo. So they said, here you go. You get one of three doses, 9, 12, or placebo. Among adults with obesity and cardiovascular disease, retatrutide delivered weight reductions between 22 and 23% compared to a reduction of 3% with the placebo. So 9 milligram dose, they lost an average of 22% of their body weight or 53 pounds. On the 12 milligram dose, they achieved 23% or 56 pounds weight loss on average. So then they looked at they did additional analyses, found that meaningful cardiovascular risk reduction, highest dose delivering an average reduction of, ready for this, 37% reduction in triglycerides. We struggle with getting triglycerides to go down, and I could do it with 37%. Are you kidding me? I'm so excited. 17% in non-HDLC, 9.3 milligrams of mercury in systolic blood pressure, and 7.5 in inches or 19 centimeters in waist circumference, and 51% in high sensitivity C-reactive protein. C-reactive protein, remember, is a measurement of inflammation. So, Diana, I don't even know what to say. Talk to us.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is also incredible data. It's interesting because on one hand, so this is, of course, incredible data. On the other hand, I don't know how much longer we can ethically do clinical trials with a placebo
with
group.
With a placebo,
people
right.
with established cardiovascular disease. Because we know we have therapies, right? We know semaglutide is approved. We know liraglutide, dulaglutide. Now tirzepatide's got great data. So I don't think this era is going to go on much longer. But certainly this is, you know, really remarkable. I do want to point out that they did look at 3-point MACE and 5-point MACE. And while there was certainly a trend toward improvement, it was not statistically significant. Now, I think some might look at that and say, oh, well, what does that mean? You know, but I am not worried about that because this is an 80-week trial, which, yes, you know, that's a decent amount of time. But typically to see these cardiovascular events emerge, you usually need a much longer trial. I think of like dulaglutide and the award, like that was 5 years, right? So I'm not, you know, they need a proper cardiovascular outcome trial to really assess that. But I think, like you mentioned, all of these positive improvements in cardiovascular risk factors is really important. And it's very exciting.
Yep. And I do want to go back to just as a balance, right? So as a balance, Triumph 2, diarrhea up to 34% of people, right? This is going to be, you know, as a clinician, we're going to need to do some counseling. We're going to need to do some education. We're going to need to talk about, you know, diet and those kinds of things. Nausea up to 28% of people, constipation 17%. Decreased appetite. Well, you're going to have, this is part of the mechanism, right? We want this up to 17%, vomiting up to 16%. Everyone is not going to tolerate this medication, which is why we love having choice. You know, it is similar to other GLP, GIP medications. And I think it's really interesting. And I know you and I both see this in clinical practice. You pick one and they're like, oh, I can't do this. And you go, can we just try one more? And then the same person who couldn't, like, they were miserable, tries a different brand, and all of a sudden it's fine. And we can titrate up and there's no issues, right? So just because someone has an issue with one of them, please, as a clinician, don't give up on them, right? Try to get them to try at least one other, because sometimes the side effect profile is completely different depending on the medication they're taking at the time.
Right. And we also know there's a lot of counseling and education we can do to help people as they're eating and to really help reduce these side effects. And also, I mean, everything right now is just top line. So we don't know, you know, just because someone experiences constipation in the first week doesn't mean they have ongoing constipation. Same with all of the side effects, right?
If so they report it once, it has to be in this data right now. Right.
Exactly. So I think, you know, it's very encouraging, and especially the fact that we can get such remarkable improvements, even with these lower doses. I think that's great. One other thing I want to point out is that the weight reduction in Triumph 3 is actually a little bit less than it was in Triumph 1. So in Triumph 1, if you recall, it was actually the highest dose was 28.3%, which is totally mind-blowing, right? Like 30, that's like close to 30%, like bariatric surgery range. And this is a little bit less, although still super impressive. And one of the thoughts is just because the patient population did include people with diabetes. Not everyone had diabetes, but some people did. That may have affected it, since people with diabetes don't lose as much weight, which makes Triumph 2 all the more remarkable, the fact that they did lose, you know, 20% of weight and they had type 2 diabetes. So, but that might explain kind of some of the differences we see from trial to trial.
I think another interesting thing that I see is discontinuation rates appear to be dose dependent. 3.8% for the 4 milligram. Ready for this? 11% for 9 milligrams and 7.7 for the 12 milligrams. Compared to almost 5% on placebo. So some people discontinued their placebo medication because they had side effects, right? So we need to remember that even if we give somebody placebo, they can have perceived side effects, right? So to me, the discontinuation rate is not so great that I'm worried about it, right? If somebody is having severe side effects, we of course stop the medication. I'm not saying we push and push and push by any stretch, but there is, you know, I mean, when you see that 5% placebo discontinuation, then it I think it sort of eases my worry about discontinuation from the other doses.
Right. It's interesting what the future of GLP-1 and incretins will look like, because if you can get less side effects and get, you know, less weight loss, if desired, with a lower dose, is there a need for all of these other molecules? And I guess I kind of wonder over time what might happen. Like, will we eventually see, like, will there still be a need for liraglutide? I mean, even exenatide, the extended release was discontinued. Like, no one was using that anymore, right?
Right.
And it caused those little nodules under the skin. So, right, that just, it wasn't performing as well as the newer agents. So, you know, it'll be interesting. Like, dulaglutide, as great of a molecule as it is there still going to be a need for it when you've got these super more potent, and you could just use maybe a lower dose of it if needed, if you don't need all of that glucose lowering and weight loss. So, I mean, we don't know, but, you know, I guess we'll find out in the next few years, is this agent and others start to become available.
Absolutely. And I guess my close is they didn't report any CGM metrics.
I know.
So as you and I are huge fans of technology and time and range, so Insulin Icodec is the first product in the United States with time and range in their package insert. And I was truly hoping that in the, at least in the diabetes side, so the Triumph 2 trial, that we were going to get some time and range data. And so we're hoping that maybe we'll see that when we get the full readout of the studies.
Yeah, it's a good point, right? We would love to see CGM, especially in Triumph 2 with people with diabetes. So yeah, I hope they did it, but we just don't know. We're not privy to that info. So
as we close, everything that is, high level readout is more to come.
More to come. But speaking of that, there are people out there that are already getting retatrutide off of what I've been told is the gray market. So people are getting it. Often from telehealth or from, it's being shipped from outside the country. So we're not getting into the massive details on that. But the reason I use that as a transition is because there was a really interesting article that was published in JAMA about online prescribing of GLP-1 receptor agonists. And the first author is one of our dear friends, Ashwin Chetty, who was a close concerns associate and now is in med school at Princeton, I think.
Yale.
Right? Oh, sorry, Yale. So anyway, really interesting article where they basically used a simulated patient profile that met GLP-1 eligibility criteria. And they tested out this prescription on a bunch of different telehealth websites to kind of see what would happen. And so they solicited.
So hang on. So this is like a secret shopper study.
Yes, it is.
I love that idea. Okay, so talk to us. Let's talk about secret shoppering for medication. Wow. Yes. I love this.
Yeah. So they solicited from 49 websites, 17 sold compounded only, 5 sold it branded only, and 27 sold both. Of these sites, 45, so it was about 92% prescribed it, and 34 mailed the medication, so about 70%. Of the 4 non-prescribing websites, 2 required blood work, 1 denied a prescription based on internal data indicating an existing prescription from another website. So that's like good tracking, right? They're kind of seeing like someone's trying to scam the system, right?
Right.
Then 1 initially prescribed but later withdrew the prescription due to a mismatch between the patient's photo and reported weight. I think that's why aren't we doing that? Like, I mean, I guess there could be some bias, right? Because someone's face may not represent their entire body, but maybe it should clue that there should be a face-to-face encounter, right? Anyway, okay. So overall, the secret shopper study found that online GLP-1 prescription vendors often did not require any clinician interaction. They relied only on questionnaires. And then several of the findings suggested limited oversight over these prescriptions, and that the prescriptions issued despite missing required photos, and prescriptions were issued within 5 minutes or less. 2 of the websites indicated the presence of an internal database of GLP-1 prescriptions across websites. Yet, despite this information, 1 website overturned a clinician's initial prescription denial and prescribed it anyway. And overall, clinician engagement in online GLP-1 prescribing may be substantially lower than previously suggested. Also, this study found that compounded GLP-1 sellers asked leading questions about personalization, added supplements, and modified formulations and dosages. And there was limited clinician engagement, especially when prescribing compounded GLP-1s with uncertain safety, efficacy, and quality. So this could, the authors conclude, this could potentially increase risk of medical and financial harm. And just to clarify kind of that last statement about the leading questions. So pharmacies are only supposed to compound if there's a medical need or there's a shortage. And there's no longer a shortage of GLP-1, so there has to be some type of medical need. And it sounds like these pharmacies are saying, oh, well, maybe you have a B12 deficiency, right? Right? All right, we'll mark that, and then we'll add a little B12 and compound this for you. So it sounds like that's how they're getting around it. So Natalie, what do you think of all this?
You know, this is hard because part of the challenge is what? Access. Mm-hmm. People are going to online pharmacies because they're unable to get what they're looking for in, you know, regular clinical care coming into our practice. Now, some of it is because insurance won't cover it. And what happens is these online pharmacies, although they're still expensive, are certainly cheaper than the cost of the medication when you go to your regular pharmacy and get the legal, legitimate drugs, right? So it is a cry for help to for people to have access. It is also a very difficult thing to hear because my heart is like, but what if they've had a history of something that we wouldn't use a GLP-1? What if they've had a history of pancreatitis for some reason? What if they have a history? I could go in there right now and say I have nothing at all. And now that I know I need to look bigger, am I going to just push my face towards the camera and make myself look like I've gained weight? Right? So that my face matches what my BMI I'm claiming to have. There's a lot of uncertainty with it. And it scares me a little bit for the person seeking these medications this way.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, you could always use AI and just create a photo with like a larger face, right? So without any like face to face.
Right. Take my picture and make me gain 25 pounds and then I qualify. You don't know because you're not seeing that there's no video visit involved. There's no, right? Like this is a problem.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm looking at this and like some of the, there was a lot of compounding that went on. It says, you know, 32 prescribed a compounding GLP-1. Several of them were these sublingual, including sublingual liquid drops. And it's like, we don't have any evidence those formulations even work. So that's like also pretty concerning, like the safety and the effectiveness of it. But to your point, yeah, even though we have the direct programs through Novo and Lilly, unfortunately, like people are going online because they are looking to see if they can get it cheaper. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, I think just shines a light on the concern. It's still here. It's very easy for people to get it. I would imagine it's probably easy for under like people younger, like teenagers, to just go online. Like they could just say, oh, I'm older, like I'm over 18, whatever, and also get it. So there's a lot of concerns here.
Yeah.
And I hope it leads to, I don't know, some better practices where people are ensuring the safety of these medications. But I don't know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In the meantime, like all healthcare professionals on deck, like I think it's always good to ask your patients about it in, of course, a non-judgmental way. But I think probably more people than we realize are taking these and they may not even feel comfortable sharing it with their healthcare team.
Right.
So we just need to create like a comfortable, safe space that they can share it and we can hopefully help them access the safest options of these drugs.
I absolutely agree with you. And shout out to these authors. This is really creative and innovative thing to do, right? To say, hey, we're using these. We all recognize that they're out there. I mean, we're not. We actually, I don't send prescriptions this way or encourage people to do it. But it's happening. And they to have the creativity to think, okay, let's create a patient, let's do this and see what we get back, to really get a touch base on what's happening out there. Really impressive, creative scientific research.
Yeah, I love it.
I do.
Yeah, it's awesome. So kudos to them. So anyway, that is our update today. Lots of excitement. We have a lot more because we'll be both going to ADCES soon, and I'm sure we'll have a ton to report back from that conference. So stay tuned. But as for now, that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.